This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It would be hard, I think, to find a precedent for the bizarre split personality of Washington this week while the government mobilizes to implement one of the most important changes in the U.S. healthcare system. A majority of lawmakers in the House of Representatives is actively campaigning to shut the law down before it goes into effect. And there's government shutdown looming. Even though everybody in Congress says they don't want it at this hour, the government is also mobilizing to shut itself down. This hour, we want to help you to understand what impact all this may have on you. Could be a lot, could be almost nothing, depending on where you live, whether you have health insurance or work for the federal government. First off, with a campaign going on to shut down Obamacare, which is now a synonym for recession or taxes or Ebola virus, depending on where you stand politically, this media campaign has certainly helped to create a sense of alarm and menace about the law, which is supposed to take effect tomorrow. We'll let you know where the government shutdown process stands and other even more alarming dramas of self-immolation Congress is planning. We will also answer your questions shortly about your own fears and concerns regarding the Affordable Care Act. But we begin with the fear itself. The fear generated by the media campaign turning Obamacare into a political curse word and the more general and completely expected fear of change that accompanies the implementation of any law that transforms the status quo, those fears are all mixed up this time. Dante Cini is the director of the American Communities Project at American University. The fear is real, he says, and statistically significant, but figuring out what people fear, that's a tough one, says Dante.
It would be hard to know exactly what people are scared of without very, very long conversations with them. There was interesting, there was a CNBC poll that came out fairly recently now that showed that people actually don't really mind the Affordable Care Act so much. They're scared of Obamacare. I don't think they know those two things are the same thing. But when I look at the numbers about how people feel about Obamacare, what you see is that it does strike me as fear of change. The current system works a certain way. Something's coming. We're not really sure what it is, and they're concerned about it.
So if we break down the map county by county in America, who's scared the most? Who's embracing the act without a problem?
Well, embracing the act without a problem is hard to find, but there's data out there on the number of uninsured in every county. So we group them by four, you know, people with the best insurance, second best, third best, and people with least insurance. And it really is, there's pretty uniform disapproval of the Affordable Care Act across the board. There's slightly less when you get to that group where people are not well insured, the least insured people in America. They're 45% approve, 49% disapprove. The most interesting thing to me is, you know, you're talking about places where at least 20% of the people in the community, in the county, don't have insurance, and they're still opposed to the act. And the reason why, when I start looking at the numbers, you'd have to have some really long conversations with people. But the thing that jumps out with you is obviously places with the least amount of insurance are also places with the lowest incomes. And what they're being told or what they're hearing is, I'm going to have to buy insurance now. I don't have any money. So even if it's $100 a month, I can't afford that right now. And that's how they're viewing this debate. The system we have now may not be good for them, but at least they know how it works, and they're envisioning spending money they don't have down the road. And I think that's one of the reasons they're really opposed.
And is that because there is a concrete issue there that, in fact, all of them or many of them will have to spend out of pocket in a way that's going to be really, really painful? Or is this another one of these cases where really the branding of the critics has superseded the branding of the advocates of this bill?
Well, you'd have to go case by case, but it does seem to be, I mean, you've got to look at what an individual situation is, but there are going to be subsidies for a lot of these people. I mean, these places with low insurance, the median household income in those places is $39,000, okay? So a lot of these places, a lot of these people in these places are going to qualify for subsidies. But they don't see it that way. And it's, even if you tried to explain it to them, they don't know what it is yet. And what happens is these people get coverage, if you want to call it that, in their own way. They don't go until they get very sick. Then they go to the emergency room and then they work out an agreement with the hospital to pay what they can pay. And they don't ever pay the full amount. So for them, the way they view this is, well, right now I'm only using the system when I need to use it. But a monthly bill to them, these are people who don't have a lot of money for rent, for food, and it's scary to them.
Although the irony is the Affordable Care Act is attempting, as one of its main missions, to prevent people from having those kinds of emergency room problems. So we'll really see that clash get resolved or get further complicated by this October 1st deadline.
That's exactly right. Because look, you know, when these people go to the emergency room, and I don't mean these people, I mean people who don't have insurance and they need coverage,
they go
to the emergency room. You know, what's happening is, you know, they're not paying the full bill. They're working on an arrangement. It's not like the hospitals are just writing that money off. What really happens is the people with insurance end up picking up the tab on that bill. I mean, in some ways, the way the current system works is those with insurance are picking up the tab for all these people, and those with good insurance are kind of complicit in, if you want to call it that, complicit in the system too. That what they're saying is, I'm okay with the way the system works now too, I think, compared to something that I don't understand yet. And it's really going to be interesting 6 months, a year from now, when this thing has been in effect for a while, to come back and look at these numbers again, particularly among places that used to have low health insurance, because we know where the counties were now, and look at what the numbers look like.
Maybe the survey then will be, do you miss your emergency room visits?
That's right.
And that's not even funny, but it's a pretty interesting test of how this could actually work.
That's exactly right. I'll tell you, the really interesting thing is, you know who won't miss the emergency room visits? And that's the hospitals.
Right.
They don't like the way the system works right now. It's the healthcare system in America is so complicated. And that's why, you know, to me, the idea that there's a lot of disapproval over the Affordable Care Act isn't really surprising to me, because right now it's just a bunch of scary ideas. Nobody knows what the reality is of it yet. They haven't seen it in action yet. And you're talking about a very big part of the economy with a lot of moving parts. And I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing the numbers you're seeing on it right now.
Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
So fear or no fear, the next phase of the Affordable Care Act goes into effect tomorrow when, among other things, the insurance marketplaces, formerly exchanges, open, allowing consumers to shop and compare prices for health insurance. We asked you for your questions regarding the changes that will go into effect tomorrow, and here to answer them is Neera Tanden, formerly the Senior Advisor for Health Reform at the Department of Health and Human Services, advising Secretary Kathleen Sebelius and working on President Barack Obama's health reform team in the White House. She is currently the president of the Center for American Progress. Neera, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So I've got about five questions here from listeners, all of them motivated, I think, in part by some of the same sorts of fears that Dante was talking about in our conversation a moment ago. Let me just give you a question right at the top. From St. Cloud, Minnesota, is there an easy way to punch in your info, pick your normal hospital or clinic, and see what is available as far as insurance goes, and for how much in plain English? What do you think?
There is. The place to go is www.healthcare.gov. That's going to provide you a series of options about health insurance. And then when you scale on those health insurance options, kind of read through them, they should provide you what hospital's covered, what clinic is covered, all in relatively easy English. That site is live now. More information will be provided on the site about options tomorrow.
And the fact that she's in, or he is in, St. Cloud, Minnesota, does that depend on the kinds of answers that that person is going to get back?
Yes, you should be able to put in your information of where you are and get information. Obviously, the exchanges are state-based, so it's going to be different for every state. So it should provide you with information that you about your options where you are.
You're still using the old jargon, exchanges. I thought marketplace is the new word. You got to get with the program here.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Right.
Having worked on the legislation, I still call them exchanges, but
they're
the same thing. Marketplaces of insurance options. It's really what we're going to have tomorrow is really the ability of people who previously didn't have insurance to really select the right insurance for them.
All right, here's a question from Ambler, Pennsylvania, and it relates back to what Dante was talking about, that people seem satisfied and comfortable with their going to the emergency room strategy, even though that's exactly what the act is trying to change. Here's a question. If I choose not to accept the insurance and remain uninsured, will things change if I need emergency health services?
People will still be able to go to the emergency rooms even if they don't have health insurance coverage. So nothing changes that way. The emergency rooms aren't going to ban people, et cetera, from coming if they don't have health insurance. So that's an option. But I really urge this listener to think through, to really go to healthinsurance.gov, and see what their insurance options are, and you'll be able to see what level of subsidy you get from the federal government. Insurance is coming in much cheaper in these states. It's less than $100 a month for 60% of folks. So it seems to me that this person, instead of thinking about emergency room health coverage, because that is a problem in the United States, we're all paying for people who visit the emergency room without health insurance. Seems like I would urge him or her to actually check out the options.
Although, Neera, there is an incentive built in, and it depends from state to state, that in that emergency room, there may be that kind of information offered, that at the end of that emergency room visit, they may be able to be signed up.
Absolutely.
Right, in at fact, that facility.
And hospitals and doctors have been really great partners with the Affordable Care Act, and will many hospitals will provide information to folks, doctors, nurses will provide information to folks about what the Affordable Care Act provides them, what levels of...
Right. A lot of people mobilized here. Let me give you two other questions here.
Sure.
Will naturopathic care be covered, acupuncture, alternative therapies, and from Dallas, Texas, children's vaccines, will they be mandatory? I have strong concerns about the safety of them, and I do not want to be told that I have no choice. What about naturopathic and children's vaccines?
So on the issue of naturopathic, that will be determined state by state. So I don't actually know if every state will offer that. That's something the states are really going to determine the level of benefits that are considered essential benefits. So I don't know if that will be covered. That's an issue at the state level. On the issue of vaccines, just a reminder that this is an insurance option for people who are uninsured. So people who today have insurance coverage will not have requirements or mandatory vaccines from the federal government. I myself urge people to vaccinate. I do think that's an important thing to do from a public health perspective. But the issue, there will not be mandatory vaccination through the Affordable Care Act. Vaccines would probably be covered. So if you get vaccinated, they will probably be covered through the Affordable Care Act, but it's the law itself is not going to mandate vaccines.
And you already dealt with our last question, that is that people who are already insured can expect minimal changes as a result of the law. But again, lots of places to get your questions answered. Neera Tanden, answering your questions about the Affordable Care Act, former senior advisor for health reform at the Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And all of you out there at thetakeaway.org, you'll find Obamacare 101, an easy click-through guide to help you with your first steps. It's a great guide. You can find it at thetakeaway.org, and it'll send you everywhere else you might need to go. Coming up, they've got till midnight, the U.S. Congress threatening to quit once again. Actually, that might help. No, it's just another government shutdown. American democracy, beautiful thing, right? Todd Zwillick, our man close to the beauty, will explain who gets burned next on The Takeaway. So it's come to this. No compromise, no movement, no government. House Republicans have decided to live with a government shutdown rather than live with the Affordable Care Act. Democrats have decided to live with a government shutdown rather than live without the Affordable Care Act. Joining me, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who followed this depressing drama straight through the weekend. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John. How are you?
So, You know, I'm so tired of hourglass and ticking clock metaphors and all this. You got any more metaphors for us?
Well, here? We're stuck with them. You mentioned in your close of the last segment, people getting burned. That metaphor has been thrown around because Republican aides have told a couple of my colleagues at Politico that they think that some of the Republican rank and file needs to put their hand on the stove in a government shutdown to learn not to do it again. Remember when you were a kid, the first time you did that, you didn't do it again after that.
So and they think Montessori school approach to Congress.
Indeed.
Yes.
Yeah. Indeed. Now, you said at the top there, John, that Republicans have decided to go with a government shutdown rather than live with Obamacare. They haven't quite decided that yet. It does look like that's where we're headed, but we've done this before, and I'm here to tell you that even though it is dire and it's the zero hour and we can come up with a lot of names for it, there is still time. The Senate is going to deal with the latest House gambit today, and then there will be some choices in John Boehner's lap. Let me give you a little bit of tape from over the weekend. John, the Senate today is going to do what they did before. They're going to take a Republican bill that has a one-year delay in Obamacare and repeals a medical device tax in addition to keeping the lights on in the government, and Harry Reid is going to strip those things out. He's going to take the Obamacare stuff out and send it back to the House. Now, some Republicans are saying Harry Reid should take it, even though Harry Reid has said, I'm going to kill this thing. Some Republicans, like Daryl Issa of California, who I spoke to in a press gaggle over the weekend, thinks there's still room for a deal, and he's pretty worked up about it. Listen to Issa.
How dare you presume a failure? How dare you? How dare you?
Harry Reid.
How dare you presume a failure?
Harry
the fact Reid. Is, the fact is, this country is based on people saying they won't do things, and at the end of the day, coming together for compromise. We continue to anticipate that there's an opportunity for sensible compromise.
Take that, Todd Zwillick. Yeah, a lot of compromise there with Daryl and the crew up there in the Senate.
It was a little tense over the weekend for sure, but it's important to hear what Harry Reid has actually said about what Mr. Issa thinks has room for compromise. Here's what Harry Reid says he's going to do if he gets any amendments, any more moves that deal with tinkering, repealing, delaying, or defunding Obamacare. Listen to Reid.
Let them send us whatever they're going to send us, and we'll send it right back to them, stripped of all the craziness that they have. So we've made it clear. The only way to keep the government open is to just do the right thing.
And what is the right thing? Now in civics class, I mean, the right thing is to handle this in the normal legislative process. Is he trying to end the entire linking the continuing resolution to any amendment ever, or is it just here and now?
Obamacare. It's Obamacare that they don't want to negotiate on. You know, one of the amendments that's going to the Senate today, repealing the medical device tax, lots of Democrats support that. They voted for it in the past. They're just saying, we're not going to negotiate on this with a gun to our head. We can talk about this $40 billion medical device tax. A lot of these manufacturers are in our states. We'd love to repeal it, but we're not going to do it under these circumstances. A lot of this is about implications beyond a government shutdown. And John, don't forget about that debt limit breach coming October 17th. There is a lot of posturing going on in trying to improve people's negotiating position for the debt limit, which is really far, far more serious than what we're dealing with today. So you heard Harry Reid there say, we're going to strip out all what he calls this craziness. He can do that easily later today with 51 votes. He doesn't have to deal with 60 votes. He doesn't have to deal with Ted Cruz or anything like that. And then here's the way the rest of the day goes. The decision, really, procedurally, we know this. The decision is John Boehner's. John Boehner will decide by the end of today whether to have a government shutdown, whether to accede to the will of his, 40 or 45 staunch conservatives who at this point do want to shut down rather than have not hold the president's feet to the fire on Obamacare. But John Boehner has another choice. John Boehner can collect as many Republicans as he can get. Maybe he'll lose 50. And then he can call up Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and pass a continuing resolution. What Harry Reid calls the right thing is just a clean funding of, government funding through November 15th, probably with no other policy riders on it. Just keep the lights on as going until November 15th and keep negotiating on spending until then. John Boehner can decide to do that. John, we do not know what thing he's going to do. And of course, I don't have to tell you that the implications for his leadership and his speakership are really tied up in this decision that he's going to make by the end of the day.
Well, if he doesn't go that route, then we're going to enshrine in Congress, at least for the foreseeable future, this gun-to-the-head approach on virtually every issue, right?
Well, this is part of the concern of Democrats, and President Obama has said exactly as much, that it's not that he's not willing to negotiate at all. He's not willing to negotiate under these circumstances. And more broadly, again, even more important, not willing to negotiate with the hostage being breaching the debt limit, having bond prices go through the roof and interest rates. That's part of the concern from the White House. Now, this is not the first time we've seen brinksmanship over a government shutdown. That part of it is really not so dire. But I think the real difficulty between Republicans and Democrats here is two things. One, it's Obamacare itself, the president's signature domestic policy achievement. You just spent 20 minutes talking about it. The president has no political interest in tinkering with it under these circumstances. Certainly not repealing it. John, the second part of this that makes the negotiation really, really difficult is that this isn't even really a fight between Republicans and Democrats at this point. It's a fight between Republicans and Republicans, the John Boehners and Mitch McConnells versus the right. The Democrats have very little incentive to put a stop to the fight because they're benefiting politically from Republicans right. beating each other up. When it comes to the 0 hour of a shutdown, will the adults get in the room and say, okay, the gesticulations are over, the fun is over? We have to wait and see. Nobody knows the way this is going tonight, but John Boehner can make a decision to avoid the shutdown tonight, or he can go the other route.
Well, Todd, why don't you go see if you can get some other lawmaker to fly off the handle at you. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Takeaway Washington correspondent. A matter of increasing concern to U.S. intelligence officials, according to our part of the New York Times, has less to do with the leaks of an entire security archive to the world by fugitive Edward Snowden, and more to do with a mysterious loss of signal in the monitoring of Al-Qaeda. Suddenly harder to track, a major communications channel gone silent, with no reason to believe that the organization is any less active in planning and recruiting than it's ever been. Joining us now, Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly has happened here, and can we date it to the apparent change of leadership in Al-Qaeda?
No. What you can date it to is in August, came out that Al-Qaeda was plotting against U.S. embassies in the Middle East. The way the United States got that was by listening in on some conversations between senior Al-Qaeda leaders. That got out to the public, and by getting out, it signaled to Al-Qaeda that we were indeed listening to them on what they were communicating on at the time, and that has led to a significant drop-off in the use of that particular communication that we were honing in on. Now, that's been felt over the past month and has been more acute than what has been felt in the past few months in regards to counterterrorism surveillance because of the stuff released by Edward Snowden.
So is it a matter of a blown cover that the warning basically blew a line of communication that might have been useful now? Or did the intelligence community really understand that they were pulling the ripcord on that channel of communication if they issued this warning?
Well, they could have issued the warning without it coming out that it was a direct communication between the Al-Qaeda leader in Pakistan and the Al-Qaeda leader in Yemen. What basically happens is that if the government finds out something very specific that you said, let's say, to me on the phone, then you would know that line is something that they're listening in on. So by it getting out that the government knew exactly what was said at a particular time about a particular event, that signaled to them that, hey, we shouldn't use that phone anymore.
So how blinded does this leave investigators in terms of tracking future attacks?
It's hard to say. It's very difficult to measure a lot of this stuff, but I think that it is something that has concerned them significantly because they saw this drop off in communication, and I think they've been very successful in tapping into these things. And when they go underground, they get very worried because this is one of the strongest tools that they have to fight terrorism. So they now have to find out the new ways that they're communicating. Some people believe that they start to use more couriers, which sort of slows down Al-Qaeda, which means that it's just simply passing information from person to person. But they don't know, and we don't certainly know what they know. So.
And the reasons for being very specific in disclosing what was behind the warnings in August may have political reasons behind it, and the intelligence community might be observing with some frustration the details of those disclosures. Have your sources expressed any frustration over all this?
No. The issue with the leak was that the government didn't want it to get out, that it was a communication between these two leaders. And the problem was is that that did get out through the media, and that's what's really hurt them. They could have issued the warning for the embassies without specifically releasing that information, but that got out. And that's what they say has hurt them.
Once again, a leak, not from Snowden, but certainly very concerning about the monitoring of Al-Qaeda. Michael Schmidt, a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
a growing scandal that may be a symptom of a system overwhelmed with wounded soldiers living with severe disabilities, some of which have complex treatments or no treatment at all. According to an investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting, the VA has turned to opiates and synthetic opiates for treatment, hydrocodone, oxycodone, methadone, and morphine. These prescriptions are up 270% in the past 12 years. Joining us now is Aaron Glantz, reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. His report is part of the launch of a new investigative public radio program called Reveal, produced by CIR and PRX. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Couple of things. Since we have had two wars in the last 12 years, the idea that opiate prescriptions are up 270% might not seem unreasonable. How do you jive that?
Well, it's up against a 40% increase in the number of patients at the VA, first of all. So, you know, we have these Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who are coming home hurt, but we also have Vietnam veterans who have been hurt, and World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, all of them have also been through war. And yet we see this extreme skyrocketing rate of opiate prescription. And this is also up against some science that VA clinicians have already published in peer-reviewed medical journals showing, for example, that the overdose rate on prescription medication amongst VA patients is nearly double the national average. And another study that showed that many, many veterans with PTSD are being prescribed opiates, even though these painkillers, which of course are very similar to heroin, actually increase the risk of suicide or an overdose. And these veterans who are coming home with mental health injuries are especially at risk of overdose and suicide. So it's very concerning.
One more thing on the stats and the investigation. These rates are out of whack compared with the civilian healthcare system for similar kinds of injuries and treatments.
Well, it's really hard to compare the VA to anything. It's got a very unique patient population, as you mentioned. When we look at the civilian rates, it kind of depends on the way that you phrase the question. The CDC says that the prescription opiate rate is up 300%, but the National Institute on Drug Abuse says it's up 60%. So we thought the smartest thing to do is just compare the VA to itself. You know, over the period since the 9/11 attacks, we have all of these veterans coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury are the two signature wounds of these wars, neither of which are treated with opiates. And yet we see this 270% increase in narcotic painkiller prescriptions.
Right.
And that's what's troubling to us.
Talking to Aaron Glantz, reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Let's hear a couple of voices from your reporting. Here is a Marine Corps vet with PTSD, Tim Fazio.
I thought the painkillers were okay because the doctors were prescribing them to me. So it was okay. If the doctor's giving this to me, I'm going to take it, you know? If it makes you feel good, I'm going to take 15 of them. You know what I mean?
Now, that's perfectly understandable, given what opiates, as you've said, do to patients. But the irony here is that this isn't even a real treatment for these kinds of disorders like PTSD. Listen to psychologist and retired Army General Stephen Sinakis.
I think the opiates have an adverse effect for most of these patients. They make sleep more difficult because they disrupt your usual sleep patterns. As your sleep gets worse, your mood and your anxiety get worse, and you find yourself actually not being able to think as clearly. You have problems in attention. You have problems in concentration.
The clinical issue is the big one here, right, Aaron?
Well, and the other issue is the over-the-top nature of this. I mean, one thing that we mentioned in our story is that Tim Fazio has been prescribed over 4,000 oxycodone pills by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And he got into a cycle of addiction, and the VA continued to prescribe him opiates 3 years after they knew he was an addict. And so it's almost become the default to give these painkillers no matter what the patient comes in with.
Giving them drugs to make them feel better, but they don't go away, that's for sure. Aaron Glantz, reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, part of a new program, radio program called Reveal, produced by CIR and PRX, airing on public radio stations nationally all this week. Aaron, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Can a deep look into a big story from the past inform us about important issues today? Can it remind us of urgent questions that get shelved in the passage of time? With a mission to update and re-examine important stories with the benefit of hindsight, the independent documentary group Retro Report's latest offering takes us back to 2007.
I've seen so many soldiers get so frustrated with the process that they will sign anything presented to them just so they can get on with their lives. The system can't be trusted. And soldiers get less than they deserve from a system seemingly designed to run and run to cut the costs associated with fighting this war.
By the time Staff Sergeant John Daniel Shannon testified before Congress about the horrible conditions for some soldiers at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, it was already a blockbuster national story. The soldier blew the whistle about his shocking treatment at the Army's flagship medical facility after being wounded in the war in Iraq, a war itself going badly.
They gave me a Xeroxed map of the hospital grounds, and it was not very well photocopied. And here I am sliding down walls, sliding down brick walls outside, staggering across open areas so I can get to another brick wall to hold me up, and have no idea where to go. And mind you, my head is still bandaged at this time frame.
After an explosive Washington Post investigation of the decrepit conditions and stifling bureaucracy and their effect on the troops.
They think the system's against them. They'll recede into their rooms and not physically not come out.
This is what greets wounded soldiers. Mold, holes in walls, rats and insect infestation.
The Washington Post broke the scandal out into the open, and everyone in the media was incredulous as to how this could have happened. Substandard conditions of neglect, and in many cases, improper care for severely injured soldiers.
That mold and the Byzantine kind of environment in which these soldiers found themselves, almost Kafkaesque, became a metaphor for a moldy system which needed to be revitalized.
Retro Report asked Lieutenant General Eric B. Schoomaker what the Army learned from the scandal back in 2007 and if the stream of casualties from two wars has continued to overwhelm the system.
This really stellar achievement in improving survival had, in a sense, a downside for us in the recovery and rehabilitation, and that is that we are now beginning to see soldiers, the likes of which we had not seen in years.
In some places were better than others, but there were problems of one sort or another at every single WTU that we went to. And these problems were corrected somewhat at Walter Reed, but they're replicated across the whole system.
Noel Cook there speaking with Retro Report. He's Deputy Undersecretary for the Office of Wounded Warrior Care and Transition Policy. Much has changed since 2007. Walter Reed has been closed, at least the facility profiled in the original scandal, replaced by a modern joint Army-Navy Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. Joining me now is Harry Hanbury, producer for the Retro Report. Harry, welcome.
Hi, John.
So first of all, what's a WTU that Noel Cook refers to there?
A WTU is a warrior transition unit, and after the Walter Reed scandal, the Army created some three dozen of these around the U.S. and abroad to care for critically wounded soldiers.
And we were told, and I think the impression and tone of the stories and the coverage back in 2007 was that this was a lapse that was going to be corrected. But as we get into your report, it seems that no, in fact, this is more systemic, and it's really a sense of the system being overwhelmed.
Yes, I think in 2007, the Washington Post really shined a spotlight on a major problem that the Army was facing. They really had a major lack of systems to deal with this incoming tide of soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I should stress that part of that was because military medicine had gotten so good that a lot more soldiers were surviving.
General Schoomaker actually referred to that in the clip we just played, that the survival rate is part of the long-term problem. Is this systemic, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. It's a systemic problem, and the Army really tried to deal with this and put a lot of resources and manpower into these WTUs in 2007. And I think part of the problem is that after that spotlight turned away, There seems to have been some drift back in the direction of the bad old days before 2007. At least that's the testimony that we're getting from a lot of soldiers and official reports.
Is the sense that there are new problems emerging, that as time goes on, there are other things that are going to manifest themselves, that this is far from over?
Certainly some of the invisible wounds like PTSD, traumatic brain injury, major depression could be lingering far into the future.
Let's hear from Noel Cook again, who speaks directly to that.
We've got a wave of problems out there in front of us that are going to be coming at us in the years ahead in numbers that we can't now really anticipate. And it's going to manifest itself in broken soldiers, broken homes, children that are messed up. All this stuff is what we've got waiting for us.
And this goes way beyond facilities and individual hospitals. This is out in communities all over America.
That's right. That's right. The initial problem, I think what really captured the public imagination was the facilities problems at Walter Reed, mold and mice. And I think the deeper problems really have to do with outpatient care, the bureaucratic maze that people find themselves trapped in. And what's really striking about this story is the extent to which a lot of the major themes of the 2007 reporting and the Post have been repeated in the subsequent reporting. That's sort of failed to break that threshold and get the same level of public attention.
And there's a real sense, and this is some of the most powerful tape in this piece that you have, is from Tori Shannon, who's Staff Sergeant John Daniel Shannon's wife, speaking to you.
The Walter Reed scandal shed a lot of light, and there was a lot of attention, and, you know, all this momentum and traction was built. And within 2 years, it just fizzled away again. We're right back to where we started, and in some cases, worse than when we started.
Is that bitterness or a fair assessment of where the system is right now?
It's really hard to say. I mean, all that I can say as an outsider is that a lot of soldiers still seem very dissatisfied with the state of care that they're getting as outpatients in warrior transition units. The Army reports, based on its own surveys, that over 80% of soldiers are satisfied, and that number has stayed pretty steady for the past several years. But there's been a steady stream of bad news and complaint. There was a report last year that said that soldiers in wheelchairs were made fun of and that it was a toxic environment. And these still seem to be things that the WTUs are grappling with.
Well, it's great that you look back to help us to look forward. Harry Hanbury is a producer for Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All the legislative battles in Washington over the Affordable Care Act and government operations, debt limits, calls for delay of the ACA, parallel disputes at the state level. Because of the politics of the act and the ways in which states can choose to opt in or opt out of aspects of the law, the variations state to state as the Affordable Care Act rolls out tomorrow will be great. Florida's experience will be completely different from Oregon's. New York and New Jersey also couldn't be more different. Everything from the marketing of the act to the ways in which federally trained navigators are being deployed to help consumers to whether or not a state has decided to create its own insurance exchange or marketplace. Here to give us the picture in these four representative states, Christian Foden-Wenzel, a reporter for OPB in Portland, Oregon, Fred Mogul, a reporter for us here at WNYC in New York City, and Gina Jordan, a reporter from WLRN in Miami, Florida, the state where there has been perhaps the greatest pushback.
Well, for one thing, we have a lot of folks uninsured. About 25% of our population is uninsured. And they're not getting any help from the state, really, finding out about this marketplace that opens October 1st, because state leaders really don't want it to open October 1st.
And in your state, it's fair to say that the political leadership is really working against the grain as far as implementation is concerned.
Definitely. One of the things that popped up recently is that state leaders decided that there should be no healthcare navigators allowed in the county health departments. They sent out a letter sort of banning these navigators. And they said that this was an issue of privacy. They were very concerned about what these navigators would do with people's personal information. But in the end, it turns out that a lot of these buildings where the county health departments are located are actually owned by the counties. And so the counties are stepping up and saying, the state can't tell us what to do and who we can let in our buildings. So far we have very large counties, Pinellas in St. Petersburg. We've got Miami-Dade and Broward all saying we're going to ignore this order.
And the navigators, of course, are these federally funded advocates and activists who are trained by the federal government to help people negotiate the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. All right, that's Gina Jordan's experience down in South Florida. And Fred Mogul here at the WNYC in New York City, you're dealing with two markets, two states, New York and New Jersey. Very different approaches or very similar approaches?
Well, very different because New Jersey is run by Republican Chris Christie. He decided not to set up a state exchange, like about two-thirds of the states, mostly Republican, but a couple Democrats. New York, run by Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat. We're in the one-third that are setting up their own exchanges. Set up your own exchange, the feds give you a lot more money. So that Navigator program we've been talking about, New York's got $27 million to do it. Wow. Want to guess what New Jersey has? $2 million. Mm-hmm. Think about how many people you can hire. There's about 50 groups in New York with 96 subcontractors, with 430 official navigators and a phalanx beyond that. New Jersey's got they've got actually five organizations. I don't think they have any subcontractors. They're looking at a couple dozen navigators for the whole state. Be an interesting experiment just to see, given that difference, what sort of the yield is, you know, per 1,000 eligible enrollees, how many you get in New Jersey versus how many you get in New York.
And what the impact would be on health in New Jersey versus New York. I mean, some of the communities are directly adjoining and are very similar in terms of urban density. Would you expect that there would be a difference a year from now in terms of the health outcomes between the two states that would be measurable?
Well, in both cases, you're going to have more people going into the system. That's demand in terms of supply of healthcare, clinics, hospitals, and so on. Both states are concerned. I think everyone's concerned nationally how many doctors and nurses and so forth there are to serve the new people coming in.
So, Gina Jordan, going back to Florida now, you mentioned the county is deciding to defy the order about the navigators coming into county buildings. Do people have a way of making their way to the Affordable Care Act, or will the roadblocks really prevent people from taking advantage of this if they're eligible?
I think the main roadblock right now is that a lot of people don't realize they can just go online October 1st and do this. They just haven't heard anything. There hasn't been any great announcement from the state. I think the other big problem is that the Spanish language version of this website will not be functioning as the other one will October 1st, and that will disproportionately affect a lot of Floridians who are uninsured.
I could ask any of you this question, but Christian Foden-Wenzel in Portland, what are the deadlines between now and the actual insurance activation?
Yeah. Well, October 1st, everything opens and you can go and enroll. Then starting January 1st, that's when you actually can get the insurance. Then a few months after that, March, that's when the enrollment period ends for individuals. This is so that you have to buy insurance. You can't have a car accident, be in the back of the ambulance and say, oh, yeah, I want my insurance now. So they want to get you in there. Small businesses, though, their open enrollment period is open throughout. And actually, there's a number of small businesses here who are quite excited about this idea, because now the small business goes to the exchange and says, okay, well, I can afford this much for each of my employees. And the employees go to the exchange, and then they can pick their own. So you might have LifeWise. I might have Providence. Somebody else might get Kaiser. And that's better insurance for them locally. They can decide, you know, who's the better network locally. So it's quite exciting for a lot of people here.
Christian Foden-Wenzel in Portland, Oregon. So, Fred Mogul, between now and those deadlines that Christian talked about, a lot of marketing money is going to be spent, and all of this money on the navigators virtually is going to be spent, yes?
Right. New York has $40 million to spend over 2 years, $20 million obviously each year. I think that's a lot more than almost any other state. I don't know that New Jersey has any, frankly, given that they have $2 million for navigators alone. So it'll be interesting to see how they use that, what sort of clever advertising they have. Ours aren't quite as chipper as the ones that they have in Oregon, and even Delaware and Colorado have some fun ones. But we'll see whether it goes out on the web, whether it goes out on our very expensive broadcast outlets. There's a lot to be worked out there.
And really, if we think about marketing, Gina Jordan, there's a competition of brands here, and you're seeing it down there in Florida. It's the competition between the marketing that says, here's how you can get into the Affordable Care Act, and the counter-marketing from political leadership in Florida and the commercials that you're seeing that says Obamacare is hurting America. Which is going to win?
Well, I think ultimately the people will be signing up, and I think that that will win because so many people in Florida don't have coverage. Even folks who opt not to buy it, at least up till now, I think will be changing their minds in lieu of paying a fine. So even Governor Scott has admitted, yes, this is now the law of the land in spite of all of our efforts. So I think the people will win.
Let me chime in, though. One thing, and Christian alluded to this, that we shouldn't forget is that these are private insurance companies. It's easy kind of to forget that. For them, it's the chance of a lifetime, really, to sign up a whole bunch of new people. And they're especially dying to get their hands on those young, healthy people. Those are the ones they don't pay that much, but they hopefully don't pay out a lot of claims on these patients, and they'll hopefully have them for a while.
It's funny to see how these is being rolled out everywhere. Just a little bit about Oregon's campaign on advertising. I think we're spending about $27 million, which is big for a small population state. But what they've done is they've asked local musicians to sing about Obamacare. And it's quite clever because the advertising people know that a lot of musicians don't have health insurance. So they've really quite excelled themselves and quite excited about this. So it's very different in different states.
Christian Foden-Wenzel, reporter for OPB in Portland, Oregon, Fred Mogul, reporter for WNYC in New York City, and Gina Jordan, reporter for WLRN in Miami and South Florida. Gina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks guys.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, John.
Give us a call with your questions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post your questions at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Visit thetakeaway.org. You'll find Obamacare 101, an easy click-through guide to help you with your first steps. It's a great guide. Find it at thetakeaway.org. And tomorrow, the remarkable story about an inspirational but uncompromising tough music teacher. Do you have a tough teacher that changed your life? Share the story with us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.